Bashar al-Assad, whom even Western-sponsored polls, which have been taken for years in Syria, have shown to be overwhelmingly the one person whom they want to be Syria's president. However, whatever the reason might be as to why the US regime is stealing Syria's oil, the US regime theft is equally illegal and equally a gangster operation. That is, it is running there. This operation has been going on for a decade now under American presidents Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and currently Joe Biden. President Trump ordered the withdrawal of U.S. occupation forces from Syria in December 2018, but the Pentagon would not agree with the order, and the U.S. troops remain in two locations, one in the oil-rich northeast region and the other in southeast Tanf. What does Washington truly care about in West Asia? Democracy? Human rights? Or good governance? The answer is none of these, but the access to resources such as oil. The chaos in the region can help the U.S. seize more natural resources and show its influence. Washington's recent airstrikes towards Syria and theft of its oil are a vivid demonstration that it is greed and interest that have dominated U.S. diplomacy, not democracy and good governance, as it has always claimed. For many years, the U.S. has launched countless wars in countries such as Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria under the banner of countering terrorism. It now appears that those counterterrorism operations are perhaps a tool to serve U.S. interests. Washington's talk of counterterrorism is only an empty one because, judging from the results, the U.S. and the rest of the world have not become safer. Instead, more chaos was brought to them because of Washington's so-called war on terror. Moreover, China daily has lambasted the continued plundering of the Syrian oil by U.S. occupation forces across the Arab countries, saying that the looting is a disgrace and a shame to Washington. The Daily made the assertion in an article published recently following reports that a convoy consisting of more than 100 U.S. military tankers had carried thousands of liters of crude oil from the northeastern Syrian province of Hasaka to the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region in northern Iraq, stressing that the matter shows the U.S. greedy appetite for oil is still not satisfied. The paper said it is easy to understand the fact that U.S. troops steal oil from Syria, as theft has long been their profession. Yet it is rather informative that the U.S. troops transported their stolen oil to Iraq, which is, in the general impression of the public, a country rich in oil. The top Chinese newspaper pointed out that the theft always reflects negatively on the people of the countries whose resources are stolen by the United States, underlining Iraq's high rates of poverty despite the country's richness in oil and other natural assets. The paper said despite being the fifth largest oil producer of the world, much of Iraq's population is still living in poverty, adding there might be many reasons, but pillaging by the U.S. is one of them. There have been many reports of the U.S. having seized and shipped gold out of the country. The U.S. military has stationed forces and equipment in northeastern Syria, with the Pentagon claiming that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. However, Damascus maintains the deployment is meant to plunder the country's rich mineral resources. Former U.S. President Donald Trump admitted on more than one occasion that American forces were in the Arab country for its oil. Midstream.
8 Israeli F-16 fighter jets attacked both Aleppo Airport and Damascus Airport simultaneously in Syria last week. The world moved on. Syria didn't. Maybe if the news was Syrian fighter jets bombed Ben Gurion Airport, the world would have stopped turning for a couple of days in complete awe of the horrific news. The attack of Wednesday night on Aleppo International Airport comes as an Israeli strike only months earlier took out the runway at the country's main airport in the capital Damascus. The Israeli attack tore a hole in the runway and also damaged a nearby piece of tarmac and structure in the airfield, as shown here by satellite photos. A day after the attack, Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad stated that Israel is playing with fire and exposing the security and military situation in the region to an explosion. Miqdad added that Syria will not remain silent in the face of the Israeli aggression and that Israelis will pay the price sooner or later. However, Israel is not to be blamed alone in its continuous attacks against Syria. The United States and its Western allies are all responsible for encouraging Israel to persist in aggression, threatening peace and security in West Asia. The latest round of Israeli violations against Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity was preceded by strikes of 8 U.S. F-16 and F-15E fighter jets, which hit 9 targets in Syria on August 25th. The same U.S. occupation that still maintains 19 terrorist training camps in Syria and has seized Syria's oil fields, costing Syria $100 billion so far in oil and gas sector losses. The U.S. Congress has never declared war nor authorized U.S. military force in Syria. Still, 3 successive presidents have ordered Syria bombed while giving a green light for Israel to keep attacking Syria. Before the 2011 U.S.-instigated war in Syria, the country was fully electrified with a national grid. Syria, a secular, multinational, multilingual country, had the highest educational level in the region and full, free healthcare. Now, millions of Syrians, more than 40% of the population, are displaced by the decades of U.S.-Israeli war. After that, the illegal Caesar's Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, which further cuts all supplies for food, medicine, and reconstruction. After all this, it is only fair to see Syria retaliate to every strike it endures, whether by lighting up U.S. occupation bases east of the Euphrates, or maybe, just maybe, taking Ben-Gurion Airport out of service. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. An Israeli attack targeting a Syrian airport tore a hole in the runway and also damaged a nearby piece of tarmac and structure on the military side of the airfield in Aleppo International Airport. This is what satellite photos analyzed on Friday by the Associated Press showed us. Now, the attack of Wednesday night on Aleppo International Airport comes as an Israeli strike only months earlier took out the runway at the country's main airport in the capital, Damascus, over alleged Iranian weapons transfers to the country. Now, to discuss this very important issue with us from Atlanta, Georgia, is Mr. Aqil Hanano, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Aqil. Now, Israel bombs 2 of Syria's most important airports, international airports, one in Aleppo and the other one in Damascus, just days after the United States bombed Syria as well on August 25th in Deir ez-Zor. Now, there's no doubt that the U.S. and the Israelis coordinate their attacks against Syria, but what is it that's triggering this married old couple over aggressiveness and violence towards Syria? What are they really afraid of?
Well, to be honest with you, after 12 years of war on Syria and failure to impose their own will on the country, Syria now become like a punching bag for United States to affect the events in the Middle East and in the international arena in general. I don't think this is targeted just specifically to weaken Syria. Syria already gone through 12 years of war, and those continuous attack from the Israeli entity, it's only to further advance the goal of United States vis-a-vis Russia and Iran, because we all know there is Iranian advisors in Syria, and those came with the invitation of the Syrian government, but there is no military bases of Iranian in Syria. They are attacking Syrian coasts, the murder are Syrian soldiers, there is no doubt in my mind this has nothing to do with Syria. It only has to do with the international event and the Middle East event.
Well, after the attack, we did hear Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad saying that Israel is playing with fire and it's exposing the entire region and the world, its security and military situation to an explosion. Now, we also heard him saying that Syria will not remain silent in the face of the Israeli aggression, and he threatened that Israelis will be paying the price sooner or later because of this aggression against Syria that has been going on for 10 years now. But will Syria truly be able to deter Zionist aggression against its capital and other governorates in Syria? I mean, what tool is Syria planning on using to deter the Zionists?
Well, let's be realistic. Syria at this moment cannot open another front with Israel or with anybody else. We already have four occupations in Syria. We have the Turkish occupation. We have the American occupation. We have the terrorist ISIS occupation or al-Jolani in Idlib. And then we have the Kurds separatist occupation. So to open a fifth front with any other country will weaken Syria further. So what we are doing right now, and Syria is responding by attacking the military bases of the American in Syria. And we saw that happen yesterday or day before yesterday, or we saw it happening every time the Zionist entity attacks Syria. We respond against the masters.
So do you think that we might see some sort of a retaliation by Syria similar to that we saw in 2017 by downing probably one of the planes at least?
Well, anything like this, I think, will require the approval of the pact, the Iranian, the Russian, the Hezbollah. Syria will never go to war on its own decision. The same thing, I think Hezbollah also will do the same thing. There will be a consultation with all the party, the alliance, because any war and escalation on a bigger scale will require that the other party in that alliance might be involved. So in Syria, after the war started on it, does not have the sole decision-making to go to war or not to go to war. Everything now is with consultation. Any movement you see on the part of the Iranian or Hezbollah on Syria does not happen just out of a single decision. It happened because there was a consultation and the decision made by the allies, all of them, and it's been taken from there on.
So, but some people are a bit frustrated by the Russian stance and the Russian permissive and facilitating, probably. Some people are saying that the Russians are facilitating this for Israel by some analysis who were referring to the removal of the S-300s from Syria. Yet many others think that it is about time that Syria and the axis of resistance respond to the attacks against Syria, because any attack against Syria is considered an attack against the axis of resistance, in order to ensure that this act of aggression and violence will not be repeated under the pretext of avoiding being drawn into a war whose time and place would be actually here determined by the enemy instead of by the axis of resistance. But let me ask you this. What is the main reason that is preventing the entire axis of resistance from retaliating and creating some sort of a deterrence equation similar to that's found between Lebanon and the Zionist entity? Why not create one between Syria and the Zionist entity, at least to prevent violence?
Let's be very clear. War does not be conducted with the hot head. It requires a cold reaction. You do not react immediately just because you want to take a revenge. You need to see after the reaction and taking any action against the Zionist entity, what's the situation in Syria? Do you think the American bases in Syria will be silent? Don't you know that they will be participating in any big scale war? The same thing on the Turkish part, the same thing on the terrorist group in Idlib. So we have more than one item to consider before we go ahead and launch similar war front like Hezbollah. The difference is between Russia and Iran. Russia said it from the beginning, they are not in Syria to protect the President Assad or to be party to any conflict between the Arab and the Zionist entity. Mm-hmm. Russia in there came to Syria with the invitation of the Syrian government solely to prevent the collapse of the government of Syria, regardless who's the president. And President Putin said it out loudly and clear. Lavrov said it also clearly in so many interviews. So everybody who blame Russia for what's happening to us is misplacing the blame, actually. As far as Iran and Hezbollah, like I said, I don't think at this stage we are ready for a full-scale war. Once the war started, anybody could start the war, but not everybody could end it the way they want. So
well,
there is more.
In less than a minute, Mr. Aqil, so do you believe that probably the targeting of U.S. occupation bases inside Syrian territory is kind of a retaliation against the aggression coming from both the U.S. and the Zionist entity, or that's a separate thing?
No, I believe it is retaliation, but I think it's a retaliation under the banner of the Syrian resistance, because the army did not claim any responsibility. The Syrian army did not claim any responsibility for that attack. So we're playing the game of we're not attacking you officially as a Syrian army, but the Syrian resistance in the area are attacking you. So everybody got the message that Syria will retaliate from now on against those bases every time it gets attacked by the Zionist entity.
Well, that brings it into a very hot plate for the Americans, who are looting hundreds of billions of dollars worth of gas and oil from Syrian fields. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Aqil Hanano, political commentator, for joining us from Georgia and for your contribution at this early time in the morning there. Thank you very much. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be discussing what's really going on in Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the development of events in Iraq depends on the decision of the Federal Supreme Court, which is expected to be issued this week on Wednesday in the lawsuit filed by the Sadr movement before it, calling for the dissolution of the House of Representatives elected last October on the grounds that it exceeded the constitutional deadlines in electing a new president of the republic, and then assigning a government from the largest parliamentary bloc. Pending the issuance of the decision, the tone of the political debate receded in Iraq, which resulted in more calm on the Iraqi streets. An anxious calm in Iraq in this following report.
It does not seem that eliciting the views of the Shia-Shia fighting in Iraq will lead to a calm at the political level, paving the way for the resumption of negotiations stalled for weeks. With the aim of finding a solution to the crisis in which the country has been floundering since last October. It was clear, though, that Muqtada Sadr, who wanted behind his recent move to give somewhat of a heads-up for his opponents, sensed that things did not go as he planned, which may explain his return, despite his announcement of his retirement from politics, to a violent and unprecedented escalation against the Iraq's coordinating framework. The so-called minister of the leader, also known as Saleh Muhammad al-Iraqi, who tweets on behalf of al-Sadr, lashed out for two consecutive days against the framework for not following the demands of al-Sadr, and dedicated his last statement to demand the immediate change of the head of Iraq's resistance, Hashd al-Shaabi, and to remove the Hashd from the green zone and keep it away from border controls, sending a strongly worded message to the Secretary General of Asaab Ahlul Haq, Qais al-Khaz'ali, asking him to rein in what he called impudent militias and renounce what Sadr referred to as the killers. However, choosing to absorb and ignore such statements, Qais al-Khaz'ali asked members of the movement to close all of its offices until further notice, calling on the movement's supporters not to respond to insults directed at him personally, which in turn will facilitate the extraction of conflict from the streets. This attack contrasts with al-Sadr's own praise a few days ago for the role of the Hashd al-Shaabi in ending the sedition, which, despite recording some tensions in the southern governorates, does not seem to have grounds for its ignition in the form of widespread Shia-Shia fighting. which most of the political forces in Iraq are intimidated by, since none of them can bear the burden of its grave effects on the Iraqi scene. While there was no indication of a breakthrough that might re-energize the political dialogue in the next stage, the Federal Supreme Court set a date to issue a decision in the case for dissolving the House of Representatives, making it imperative for all of Iraq's political factions to wait for it, given its decisive impact on the course of developments. However, it may come. All in all, the effort that has been made during the past few days to ward off sedition is not of normal size. None of Iraq's allies remained on the sidelines, with every last one of them intervening in order to prevent the Big Bang. What was remarkable was that Iran and Hezbollah on the one hand and the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Sistani on the other played a central role in preventing the bloodshed, in fear of possibility of something unthinkable, like a Shia-Shia civil war in an already tormented Iraq.
Now, to discuss this very pressing issue with us from Beirut is Mu'taz Al-Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mu'taz. Now, as long as there's no indication that a breakthrough in Iraq has been achieved in a way that relaunches maybe the political dialogue in the country, the Federal Supreme Court's setting of a date to make a decision upon the case of dissolving the House of Representatives seems to have a decisive impact on where things are going in Iraq. Everyone is actually waiting for it. What happens in the event that the decision of the court actually goes against Muqtada Sadr's aspirations?
Well, as we've seen in the past, for us to sit here and sort of draw an accurate description of what might take place when things don't go Muqtada's way, we'd be trying to sort of foretell the future here. What we've seen from Sayyid Muqtada and rather from his followers is that they're very erratic. So there's no telling exactly what would happen, whether they would take to the streets, especially now, with Sayyid Muqtada's decision to remove himself from political life. He's left this arena void of any sort of leadership here. Who will call the shots? Who will ask people to take to the streets or not take to the streets? This remains something quite ambiguous at the moment. We saw in the past, however, when things didn't go the way of the Sadri movement, when things didn't go their way, we saw chaos, we saw rioting in the streets, we saw a mini coup, we saw government institutions being taken over, there was violence on the streets, and we can only hope that this time, especially after the last bout of violence in Iraq, and Sayyid Muqtada finally calling his followers to remove themselves from the streets, we hope that there will be a calmer reaction to things. But as we said, if we were to draw an accurate picture, this is merely impossible at the moment.
But what was noticeably, maybe let's say, vigorous about the last statement issued by the so-called minister of the leader, meaning the al-Sadr as the leader here, and his minister known as Muhammad al-Iraqi, Muhammad Saleh al-Iraqi, he demanded that the head of the political body of Iraq's main resistance, al-Hashd al-Sha'bi, Mr. Faleh al-Fayyad, be changed, be removed from position because, and I quote here, he does not have a strong personality or mentality, and he is not qualified for the position. What does that have to do with anything concerning the dissolution of parliament or the formation of a new government in Iraq, or at least dialogue between political factions in Iraq?
Absolutely nothing. This is just an indication of political immaturity. When we start to mix, cards and mix issues and tie things that are unrelated to one another, especially in when we're talking about a very delicate situation like Iraq, this is only an indication of political immaturity. Mr. Sayyid Fayyad doesn't represent Parliament. He has nothing to do with Parliament, whether Parliament is dissolved or not. He's not related to the judiciary. He's not tied to any of these decisions. And at the same time, Sayyid al-Iraqi, Muqtada's minister, has nothing to do with al-Hashd al-Sha'bi and their political makeup. And it's not his call to make, really.
Mu'taz, that the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq is part of the Iraqi army according to a bill drafted by the parliament.
Correct. So the Hashd al-Sha'bi, yes, the Hashd al-Sha'bi is part of the Iraqi Defense Force. sort of semi-officially tied to the military. So this is another indication that this is not a call of Sadr's minister. It's not his place to say this, and it has nothing to do with parliament at all. This is just the only way that we can describe it is an attempt to cause a bit of chaos, maybe, and buy some time for Muqtada's party, for them to gather themselves, for the Sadr movement to gather themselves and figure out where they want to go from here on.
But that's a bit dangerous and a risky game to play, given that it was not the Hashd al-Shaabi that was actually maybe taking to the street, Green Zone, or anywhere else. So why in specific would someone who represents al-Sadr himself, who, by the way, thanked al-Hashd al-Shaabi for keeping peace in Iraq, why would someone like him actually call for such a statement against Hashd al-Shaabi?
Well, we can see now in the Sadri movement, even before Sayyid Muqtada's last week, even before his statement last week where he claimed he was resigning from political life, there is some sort of anarchy amongst the ranks of the Sadri movement. Okay, we're not seeing a clear line of leadership. There isn't. It's not clear who exactly is calling the shots here. Those on the streets are doing one thing. Sadr's minister is saying one thing. Sayyid Muqtada himself is saying another. So it's very unclear at the moment who is actually calling the shots in this movement. If it even is the Sadri movement that is being represented in the streets. And like you said, the Hashd al-Shaabi had no role in taking to the streets in the Green Zone, although there are some who would like to point the finger at the Hashd al-Shaabi and say that they were there putting down the protesters and opening fire, and there was absolutely no basis for this at all. The Hashd al-Shaabi took a clear decision to remain neutral during the last bout of violence and step aside even when their positions and their offices and bases were being attacked. Even when the homes of some of their commanders, the personal homes where their families were living, were being shot at, were being petrol bombed, and rioters were attacking their homes, the Hashd al-Shaabi took a decision to remain neutral and not confront the protesters.
Oh, I have one in mind who would benefit from such actions, but let us stay with the Iraqi political see in here and talk about the Iraqi coordination framework, who also in itself seems to be having some inconsistencies amongst its ranks concerning dealing with the next phase in the country. There are those who are calling for proceeding with the completion of the constitutional context by forming a new government, and those who are calling for calm, for people to just sit tight and wait until we hear something coming from the court and maybe decide later on. Is that an indication that the framework bloc might disintegrate in the event the Supreme Court actually calls for re-elections?
Well, this seems to be the case for all of Iraq. Absolute ambiguity. No one really knows what is going to happen. For those who are calling to stick by current legislation or the current constitution, or if we're going to the other end, or those calling for early elections, no one really seems to have a firm grip of what's going on. And it seems to me, it's making it more and more obvious that whatever decision is going to be made, there are those in Iraq at the moment who are sitting by and are currently waiting events outside of Iraq to take place and base their decisions moving forward on that. There are some waiting on the Iran nuclear deal. There are some waiting on Saudi Arabia's relationship with Iraq, what negotiations will bring. There are some waiting on to see what the Americans are going to bring to the table. Unfortunately, this is the case in Iraq. There are many that will, at the moment, sit by and just wait for further developments in the region and then make their decisions based on that. And this is very, very tense. This is very, very dangerous when we're speaking about a volatile country like Iraq, when we have a void in government, a void in parliament. We are going to see more anarchy in the streets the longer this void continues. These gangs were going to take over the streets. These rioters who were now, as we said, unsure who was controlling them, unsure who was calling the shots, will take momentum. And the coming weeks will show. There needs to be a firm decision taken by any reasonable and logical side in Iraq. The voice of reason needs to take place, and the country's political dialogue must move forward unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we are heading for complete anarchy.
Well, I hope that Iraqis take a chance to calm down and sit together and find a way, a peaceful way, to consider the future of their country. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Muhtaz al-Wahwah, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very pressing matter in Iraq. And thank you. Now, please stay tuned next week because we have something very, very special for you. Let's see you next week on the Middle East Train.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Though observers have recently started sounding the alarm that U.S. democracy is at stake, it would be better to argue that American democracy was never designed to be democratic. According to a new analysis, over half of Americans will have a state or federal level candidate who denies the results of the 2020 presidential election on the ballot this fall. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay with us, please. The website of Truth Out wrote, in an alarming gauge of the threat to U.S. democracy posed by the far right, over half of Americans will have a state or federal level candidate who denies the results of the 2020 presidential election on the ballot this fall, a new analysis shows. According to 538, hundreds of millions of voters will seek candidates for the House, Senate, Governor, Secretary of State and Attorney General who erroneously believe Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. The publication called every Republican nominee for those races and found that such election deniers will be on the ballot in nearly every state this fall. Out of 529 nominees that the publication surveyed, 195 fully denied the election results, either by saying so or by joining legal attempts to have the election overturned. 61 candidates didn't explicitly deny the results of the election, but raised questions about widespread election fraud of which there is zero evidence. This is far more than the amount of GOP candidates who stand in line with reality and accept the results of the election. 538 found that only 71 candidates have fully accepted the results, while 87 have accepted that Biden won but still raised doubts about the integrity of the election. In all, 256 candidates surveyed fully or partially denied the election result, while 158 candidates fully or partially accepted, or a difference of about 48% to roughly 30% respectively. Many of these candidates are poised to win, the publication finds, with good chances for 126 deniers or doubters for the House, 3 for the Senate, and at least 6 gubernatorial candidates. 538 noted, An election denier winning an election and taking office is more than a symbolic concern, adding, an election denying Secretary of State could refuse to certify an election that he or she believes was rigged. An election denying governor could attempt to submit electoral votes that defy the will of the people. And election denying senators and representatives could vote to count those electoral votes. A Bloomberg analysis similarly found that there are about 254 sitting lawmakers or congressional Republican nominees who deny the results of the election. Some of these nominees are set to take office in key battleground states like Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, where states' electoral votes could go a long way in determining the results of future presidential elections. These candidates' stances also raise questions about what the results of the midterm elections may look like, as many of them may also deny the results of their own election if they lose the vote. It is extremely alarming that such a wide swath of the Republican Party has embraced an outright lie about the 2020 election and the legitimacy of elections in the U.S. as a whole just because of their preferred candidate lost. Observers warn that U.S. democracy itself is at stake, and voting rights experts say that though 2020 saw a narrow miss with the GOP's attempt coup, future presidential elections could see more open and potentially coup attempts. Successful ones, ones that were authorized in part by voter suppression laws passed by conservatives in dozens of states in reaction to Trump's revolt against American voters. Attempts to erode and replace democracy are especially concerning, considering the right's fast decline into fascism. Many indications show that the Republican Party's most extremist voices, which currently appear to be dictating the direction of the party, are aiming to implement an oppressive regime grounded in violent white supremacist and classist ideologies.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As the cold season approaches, once again, Europe has been plunged heavily into an escalating energy crisis. In a recent move, Russia's Gazprom again halted its key gas pipeline indefinitely, a move decried by European politicians. Reducing reliance on Russian gas will not be simple for European countries, as this will require a concerted and sustained policy effort across multiple sectors, alongside strong international dialogue on energy markets and security. There are multiple links between Europe's policy choices and broader global market balances. Strengthened international cooperation with alternative pipeline and LNG exporters will be of high importance. commenting on the current issues of energy security in Europe, Iran's chief diplomat Amir Abdullahian has recently stated that Iran is strongly interested in helping the international community by having its natural share in the energy market. In this regard, some lead European diplomats believe Iran's stronger entry into the energy market is in line with the interests of the world. The world oil market undoubtedly needs a rise in Iran's oil supply, according to Javad Oji, Iran's Minister of Petroleum. "We are prepared to swiftly increase our supply to the market," he said, adding that the energy and gas crisis in Europe is a serious problem which cannot be solved without interaction and cooperation among major hydrocarbon producers. And the Islamic Republic of Iran, one of the world's largest oil and gas producers, is prepared to take action in this regard, relying on its huge hydrocarbon resources and production capacity. If the world's consumers, especially major economies, are dissatisfied with the current oil prices and supply levels and see it against their interests, I suggest that they lift the US unilateral and cruel sanctions against Iran as soon as possible and prepare the ground for Iran to return to the global oil market with maximum capacity, he noted.
Europe is trying to supply a portion of its natural gas requirements from Africa, Algeria, Egypt, and LNG from the US, but is facing two problems. The first is securing fuel for the winter, and the second is the high prices of natural gas. Its price has risen above $2 per cubic meter, whereas our highest price for a cubic meter of natural gas for our export is around 30 cents and 20 cents for petrochemical plants. But the Europeans have to pay more than $2 for a cubic meter of natural gas. This is devastating for industry, as some steel manufacturers have stated that it's impossible to continue working with the current prices. So it looks like the real loser in the war between Russia and Ukraine has been Europe.
We should pay attention to the fact that the Europeans are acting against Russia under the pressure of the United States. The Americans are trying to present themselves as an alternative to Russia in the European natural gas market. In fact, the U.S. became the largest global LNG exporter in the past month. This shows us that the Americans have plans for the global natural gas market, and this is one of them. They want to reduce Europe's dependency on Russian natural gas so that they can further pursue their political objectives in Europe.
The return of Iranian crude remains dependent on other political events, namely what's commonly known as the Iran nuclear deal. If a deal is reached to restore the 2015 nuclear accord, the Persian Gulf nation's production could rise quickly and exports will surge even sooner. Iran's energy resources are so large that in the long run it will definitely determine the stability of the price and the stability of the world's energy supply, according to geopolitical energy experts. Iran has the equivalent of over 1.2 trillion barrels of oil and gas, according to the CEO of the National Iranian Oil Company, NIOC, Mohsen Khojastemir. He has stated that Iran is now the largest holder of hydrocarbon reserves in the world, considering its new discoveries.
Despite the sanctions, we try to increase our production capabilities, and we claim that our production capacity is at 3,880,000 barrels. We may not be able to produce as much right now because the market is unfavorable for us because of the sanctions. On the other hand, we can produce natural gas condensates up to 800,000 to 900,000 barrels per day.
With regard to in-place oil and gas and also in-place liquids and condensates, we have the equivalent of more than 1,200 billion barrels of crude under the ground. Giving a breakdown of the figure, the deputy oil minister said that Iran's extractable crude reserves are estimated at 157 billion barrels, considering the enhanced recovery rate. He added that natural gas reserves are estimated at 33 trillion cubic meters. That's 116.5 trillion cubic feet.
Based on studies conducted by reliable companies like EIA, Shell and BP, it's believed that we have between $550 to $650 billion worth of in-place crude oil reserves. They have speculated that we can extract 155 billion barrels. We are consuming roughly 1 billion barrels per year. So if we decide to halt our exports, Iran has 150 years worth of oil reserves. Few countries in the world can compare to this.
The figure has come days after Iranian government officials said crude oil production in this country had reached levels seen before the United States imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, following its decision to withdraw from an international deal on Tehran's nuclear program. Media reports and government statements suggest crude exports from Iran have been at around 1.5 million barrels per day since late last year. That comes despite U.S. sanctions, which have sought to pile economic pressure on this country by choking off its oil export revenues, although lengthy negotiations over the restoration of the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, seem to be approaching their end. But Iranian diplomats insist that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed.
The current energy crisis itself is applying pressure on the EU countries to play a sensible role in the negotiations and do something to end sanctions on Iran, and want the negotiations to yield results even more than before. Because if Iran and the US return to the JCPOA, Iran will re-enter the global oil market. It's believed that if Iran makes a comeback, the global production capacity will be increased by 1.5 to 2 million barrels per day. On the other hand, global oil prices will surely decrease to some extent.
Well, even if Iranian crude isn't going to flow to the US anytime soon, that still leaves Asian buyers, such as South Korea and Japan, and those in Europe. Iran's crude will return to the market more quickly than most expect, according to Iranian officials.
I think that the 13th administration has taken a positive step in energy diplomacy by following the principle of increasing relations with neighboring countries. I think there's a stable correlation between increasing ties with neighbors and developing a robust framework of energy diplomacy. I think that as we increase our relations and trade capacity with neighboring countries, by developing far-reaching ties with our neighbors, we can witness a positive impact on our energy diplomacy, like the areas you mentioned, such as energy transit, circumventing sanctions and other issues.
If it does, it will provide welcome relief for refiners in the Mediterranean, who took around 600,000 barrels a day of Iranian crude last time round. They risk losing a similar volume of Russian barrels when further EU sanctions come into force in the coming months. And while they are not an exact match for each other, most Iranian crude would be a reasonable substitute for Urals export grade.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Here's how it looks on the page. Foreign policy seems to think with regard to the energy crisis that Europe can survive a bad winter.
Europe is in the middle of an energy crisis. Uncertainty over the flow of natural gas owing to Russia's war in Ukraine has caused a spike in prices. The price of natural gas has soared to as much as $500 per barrel of oil equivalent, 10 times the normal average, fueling fears of winter shortages and cold homes. Key commodities have already been affected. Fertilizer production, which requires large inputs of natural gas, is being shut down due to high prices. Manufacturers are hoarding gas in anticipation of future shortages. Climate change has made the situation worse, as a historic drought is drying up Europe's rivers and cutting into hydroelectric capacity. The rising cost of energy has driven a spike in inflation in the United Kingdom, while Germany has suffered the worst inflation since the 1970s energy crisis. The Business Standard reads, Iran may drain offshore crude oil cash if nuclear agreement reached. Progress toward an Iranian nuclear deal has thrown the spotlight onto a sizable cache of crude held by Tehran that could be swiftly dispatched to buyers in the event an agreement gets hammered out. About 93 million barrels of Iranian crude and condensate are currently stored on vessels in the Persian Gulf off Singapore and near China, according to ship tracking firm Kpler, while Vortexa Limited estimates the holdings at 60 to 70 million barrels. In addition, there are smaller volumes in onshore tanks. Possible full readmittance of Iran to the global crude market with the potential lifting of US sanctions comes at a complex moment for oil traders. Investors are juggling the countdown toward far tighter European Union curbs on Russian crude flows from December as part of the bloc's pushback against the war in Ukraine. In addition, the Biden administration's mammoth sale from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve will end in October. Oil price gives Iran quite a bit of credit, well deserved as well. Iran plans critical gas hub in bid for global gas supremacy. As a core element of the Russo-Iranian strategy to corner as much of the global gas market as possible in as short a time as they can, Iran's petroleum minister Javad Orji last week identified Kish Island in Hormozgan province as being a critical gas hub in these plans. Kish Island is positioned off the southwest coast of Iran with an easy transit route past the northernmost tip of Oman, which abuts east of the UAE's Ras Al Khaimah into the Gulf of Oman. From there, the Arabian Sea stretches out to the Indian Ocean, which offers unfettered access to either the east or the west. Kish Island is to be used both as a refining hub for gas for the production of sanctions-proof high-value petrochemicals production and in the manufacture of liquefied natural gas, LNG. Mehr News has done a piece on an agreement close to home. Iran-Uzbekistan signed Memorandum of Understanding on Energy OGTIP, that's Oil and Gas Technology and Innovation Park, and the Uzbek Holding Company signed the deal in Tehran in a ceremony held in the presence of Mohammad Ismail Kefayati, head of OGTIP, and Mohammad Ali Satvaldio, CEO of Oil and Gas Holding of Mr. Fish, Fergana. The document is signed for launching Fergana Technopark Cooperation and launching the Tashkent Oil Industry Innovation Center, allocating space and setting up the International Office of OGTIP at the location of Fergana Technopark and the Tashkent Oil Industry Innovation Center, and at the same time financing the establishment of the International Office of OGTIP in Uzbekistan. And that'll be the end of the news section. Do stay tuned. The world wants to transition away from fossil fuels towards green energy. But the tough reality is this. Fossil fuels are not going away anytime soon.
The notion that we'll have to remove oil and gas as our fuels and replace them with renewable energy sources has driven some to the conclusion that gas and oil have lost value. This is a false notion, as it's incorrect, because oil and gas cannot be replaced as fuel sources by any other fuel source. The experts that I have spoken to couldn't foresee the replacement of natural gas and oil with renewable sources happening even in the next few decades. Therefore, this idea that's discussed by some people is a political notion as they try to undermine the value of oil. Such discussions have a direct impact on the global oil prices.
The total amount of renewable energy that's available is growing. That's good news for a world threatened by potentially devastating climate change. But the increase in renewable energy is still lower than the increase in global energy demand overall. A transition from fossil fuels may come someday, but for now, renewable energy isn't even keeping pace with rising energy demand, so fossil fuel demand is still growing.
When you look at the global energy consumption, it's comprised of 33% oil, 25% coal, around 25 to 26% natural gas, and a small amount is supplied by nuclear reactors and the renewables. Despite huge investments in that sector, fossil fuels are still the main source. A recent report by McKinsey Projects says that in about 80 years in 2030, we'll witness the highest oil consumption rates. So there won't be a decrease in oil consumption, but rather the global consumption will reach 330 million barrels. In the most pessimistic projections for 2050, when all vehicles will move away from fossil fuels and use renewable energies instead, and the Paris climate deal is implemented and countries are forced to reduce carbon emissions, the world will still need 75 million barrels of oil.
According to experts, countries need to think through ways to ensure a reliable energy supply, and one common ground solution would be to use traditional fuels as a backup when renewables fail to carry through. They believe that some cleaner fossil fuels, such as natural gas, can be used as a backup. Since the mid-2000s, the West has become an increasingly difficult trade partner for Iran. The US and European sanctions on this country's energy sector have resulted in negative consequences for the EU in particular, because in recent years, Iran has been considered as an alternative to Russia for European energy security.
We are one of the countries that can export fuel to both Europe and Asia, and only a few countries enjoy a similar geostrategic position. We used to export 650,000 barrels of oil to Europe to Spanish, Italian, Greek and Romanian refineries. They have all been clients of Iranian crude oil. Now they are ready and eager to purchase Iranian oil again. Perhaps we won't be able to export natural gas to Europe this year, but given the fact that we rank first in hydrocarbon reserves and second in terms of natural gas, we can certainly be one of Europe's gas suppliers in the future, whether via the gas pipe through Turkey or by converting the gas to LNG.
The Caspian Sea region and the Persian Gulf hold some of the most significant oil and natural gas reserves worldwide. And Iran is the only country straddling both of these areas, making it ideally situated for energy trade. In 2009 and 2010, Iran negotiated participation in the Nabucco pipeline project, maintaining that Iran's gas reserves were fundamental to achieve the intended annual supply capacity of 30 billion cubic meters from Asia to Europe. The European-driven consortium originally sought to develop an alternative to the Russian gas supply from the Caspian Sea through Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, Hungary and Austria, possibly by using Iranian gas sources.
Iran is simultaneously present in five regional classifications: Central Asia, Caucasus, West Asia, Persian Gulf and South Asia. Meanwhile, these countries are not equal in terms of access to fossil fuels. Some of these countries are consumers and some others are producers and exporters. Because of Iran's advantageous position in this region, the Islamic Republic of Iran has the potential to become an energy hub, both in oil and natural gas export. So we have the potential to transit energy from north to south and west to east.
Previously issued U.S. sanctions, as well as the more recent EU sanctions, however, have put significant hurdles on Iranian participation in the original Nabucco plans. Though the Nabucco project also faces other issues, the prospect of achieving its supply capacity without Iranian gas reserves has been highly questioned.
Alternatives to Nabucco, including Nabucco West and projects in the Southern Gas Corridor, such as the Trans-Anatolian Gas Pipeline and Trans-Adriatic Pipeline, have served to further demonstrate the limits of any project that lacks Iranian gas sources, and in doing so have strengthened the Russian pipeline strategy. This is both a loss for Europe's realization of an alternative to Russian gas and for Iran's access to European markets.
After positioning.